Organizations like the International Rescue Committee and World Food Programme have called on. Over the past 5 years, the World Food Programme has migrated a massive portion of its budget, nearly $900 million in 2016, to providing people cash rather than bowls of rice. The World Food Programme takes the view that it is the people it serves who are in a position to decide what is best for them, the organization says in its review of the power of cash. Cash-based transfers help by giving the purchasing power to the people. The International Rescue Committee has similarly put cash allowances at the center of how it responds to refugee crises around the world, providing cash to Iraqi families newly liberated from ISIS and refugees from the Middle East and North Africa stranded in Greece. It is committed to distribute a quarter of its humanitarian aid as cash transfers by 2020, up from around 6% when the announcement was made in 2015. The amount of cash benefits that humanitarian organizations provide is still small, but it has grown by a factor of 5 in a little more than a decade. At the same time, American donors interested in extreme poverty have gotten behind GiveDirectly's work. In 2012, when I began donating, the organization raised $500,000 total. In 2015 and 2016, GiveDirectly raised more than $90 million to fund its programs. A sea change in international development is reshaping the sector. In the year after I returned from Africa, I watched as the idea caught fire. The GiveDirectly experiments had been one catalyst, but other cash programs in Brazil and Mexico had sparked a robust conversation about the best way to help the poor and middle class in developing economies. Iran cashed in all of its complex food and energy subsidies to create the first nationwide cash transfer program, and India is considering doing the same. The International Rescue Committee began to pilot cash transfer programs in disaster and humanitarian relief zones, and global think tanks produced new reports assessing the power of cash to transform lives. Most of the analyses came to the same conclusion. Cash is one of the most powerful ways to lift people out of poverty. It is not a panacea, but in many cases, it should be the centerpiece of aid programs in conjunction with other supports like schools and hospitals. At the same time that cash was becoming increasingly ascendant in international circles, I was paying more attention to the brewing economic problems in the United States. The U.S. has little in common with a country like Kenya, where GiveDirectly works. Our economy is 265 times larger, and our government and social services are significantly more robust. It feels like a stretch to compare the work of a small international nonprofit like GiveDirectly to American government programs. But as I grew increasingly inspired by the power of cash internationally, I wondered how cash transfers might beat back the economic forces that had created historic inequality in our own country. The scale of the problem was much larger and more expensive, and I quickly realized that any long-term solution would need to shift public policy and not just rely on philanthropy to reach everyone who needed it. To my surprise, I discovered that the United States already runs the biggest cash transfer program in the world, giving tens of billions of dollars, no strings attached, to struggling poor families to help boost their incomes and stabilize their financial lives. We don't talk about it much, but we have good, homegrown evidence that aligns with the international studies' conclusions that this money is well spent and lifts education and health outcomes for recipients here, just as it does abroad. And by tweaking and expanding it, we can make it possible for all American families to make ends meet. The precariat. Over the past couple years, many technology and business leaders have come to believe we need a guaranteed income because of the threat of artificial intelligence. Elon Musk and Richard Branson, for instance, believe that intelligent machines may soon create a new era of mass unemployment. In that world, they argue, there will be no choice but to help people meet their basic needs. These leaders aren't contemplating a future of wholesale job destruction in order to be contrarian or controversial. They see a meaningful difference between the impacts of emerging artificial intelligence and the automation we've already come to know. Whereas automation is what we generally think of with technology, robotic arms and ATMs, artificial intelligence is the capacity for algorithms or machines to learn for themselves. They are increasingly able to incorporate feedback from their actions and to adjust future behavior, simulating a kind of intelligence. For instance, Facebook's photo software will scan a photo you took, match it to its existing database, and then suggest that you tag that photo, "Mom." When you give it an answer, "Yeah, that's my mom," or "No, that's not her," it incorporates whether or not it got its initial prediction right into the algorithm that powered the initial match. Next time, it will know better if a person with that facial structure is indeed mom. The same goes with Google's translation software or Amazon's Echo devices, which are constantly incorporating feedback into their future performance plans. Tesla's self-driving cars improve their driving ability by collecting, storing, and analyzing all of the driving data they receive while cars are on the road. These systems aren't just automating processes, they're growing smarter over time. There's little doubt that artificial intelligence could destroy many jobs in the future, but I'm not so sure they will. Self-driving cars could replace human drivers, and smart bots might replace personal assistants. The white-collar jobs of doctors and nurses, teachers and lawyers, might be radically reshaped with the introduction of smarter technologies. But all of these things fall in the category of might happen. And there are plenty of experts who believe there's little reason to believe in the hype of artificial intelligence. They don't believe the claims that this time is different. Before President Barack Obama left office, I was a guest at a small dinner in Washington, D.C. at the Brookings Institution, a well-respected policy think tank. I was the youngest guest in the room by far, and the only one not wearing the Washington uniform of suit and tie. Jason Furman, then the chair of the President's Council of Economic Advisors, was discussing digital competitiveness in today's economy. Midway through Furman's presentation, I found an opening to ask, what are you doing to plan for a future with more artificial intelligence where there might be fewer jobs? He paused, barely concealing his annoyance with such a predictable question, coming from such a predictable source, even though I was skeptical of the claim myself. 300 years of economic history tells us that can't be true, he said curtly. It was the only question he answered that night with a single sentence. This is one area of rare agreement between the Obama economic team and Donald Trump's administration. Steve Mnuchin, Trump's Treasury Secretary, said last year that he was not at all worried about job displacement at the hands of technology. In terms of artificial intelligence taking American jobs, I think we're, like, so far away from that, not even on my radar screen, Mnuchin said. I think it's 50 or 100 more years. 9 out of 10 economists, a University of Chicago survey found, agree with Furman and Mnuchin. As Furman later explained in a seminal speech, over long periods of time, it has generally been the case that about 95% of the people in the United States who want a job at any given point in time can find one, despite massive changes in technology. Workers, technologists, and politicians have indeed often cried wolf, going back to the dawn of the Industrial Revolution. During the Luddite uprisings in early 19th century England, weavers destroyed the automated looms that were threatening their livelihoods. A century and a half later, in the 1950s and 1960s, early computers raised concerns among policymakers and business leaders that mass unemployment was just around the bend. A report written by prominent academics, journalists, and technologists called the Triple Revolution foresaw a world of historic inequality as machines dramatically increased industrial output and required, quote, little cooperation with human beings. In response to the report, President Lyndon Johnson convened a National Commission on Technology, Automation, and Economic Progress to prepare for a robot future. Yet over the decade that followed, the American economy created 18 million new jobs, many of them unheard of before. There are days when I talk to a technologist in the morning who's convinced that the end of work is looming, and in the afternoon to an academic who believes nothing has changed. They may not always realize it, but there's a lot of room for agreement between the camps if they focus on what we know. Technology has already changed the nature of work. Incomes are stagnant and unpredictable, and fewer people are able to do better than their parents, while the cost of living keeps rising. The debate about artificial intelligence is in large part irrelevant to why we need a guaranteed income today. We are already experiencing one of the most significant economic dislocations in modern history. We don't need to predict the future to know that we need to respond to the problems of the economy of the present. Regardless of how artificial intelligence evolves, a guaranteed income is the best tool to provide financial stability and opportunity to people who already need it. To understand how our new economy, defined by technological advances and globalization, affects the bottom lines of working people, two researchers, Rachel Schneider and James Morduck, set out to monitor the day-to-day financial behavior of 235 low- and middle-income families over the course of a year. They tracked all money in, all money out, what they spent it on, and why. They combined that data set with anonymized statements from Chase bank accounts to create an even larger sample. The top-line conclusion from their work? While income inequality gets a lot of attention, financial instability and the challenges that come with weathering the ups and downs of unpredictable income are just as problematic, if not more so. I worked with a woman on the Obama campaign who lived that instability every year. A Chicago local, she didn't have a fancy educational pedigree or deep campaign experience. But for all that her resume lacked, she had a dedication and passion that matched or exceeded everyone else's to put her senator in the White House. I remember one night in the campaign office, after almost everyone had left, she told me what her life had been like over the past several years. She worked at the Navy Pier, a local amusement park, from May to September, and took as many hours as she could. When the pier closed in the fall, she turned to odd jobs, babysitting, and any kind of temp work she could find, scrounging and saving until spring came around again. Technically, she had an income for much of the year, and while I don't know for sure, she probably did not appear in any poverty statistics. She lived right on the brink, one month to another, hoping for no major setbacks. She is one of the tens of millions of temporary workers this economy has created. Headlines tell us that unemployment numbers keep hitting record lows in the United States, but these numbers mask the human effects of precarious work. My colleague and people like her live in a precarity trap that Schneider and Morduck describe in their work. Without basic economic stability, Schneider and Morduck write, their choices are often difficult, and they're forced to make them frequently. Short-term imperatives undermine long-term goals. Saving and borrowing need to be recalibrated with the spikes and dips of their income. The consequences of bad decisions can compound, and quickly. Stress and anxiety make it all harder. In a separate study, the Pew Research Center asked more than 7,000 Americans to balance the trade-off between reliable income and more income. 9 out of 10 said they would rather be paid less and have the money arrive regularly. Most of the people in these studies, like most Americans today, can find some kind of paid work, but the kinds of jobs that are available to them fail to provide the security of a reliable income. 150 million Americans are living from paycheck to paycheck, and it isn't because they aren't trying hard enough. Some might wonder, are they just not saving? Are they buying too many new gadgets and fancy cars when they should be diligently socking money away into a rainy day fund? Almost to a fault, every poor and middle-class person in these studies was attempting to build a nest egg. Nearly all the participants had savings accounts, and many of them thought up ways to make it harder for them to touch that money. One woman in Mississippi purposefully opened a savings account in a credit union an hour's drive away from her home. She cut up her ATM card to make it harder to withdraw money from it, and she destroyed her checkbook so she wouldn't be tempted by payday loans, which often require a signed check as collateral. Despite many similar stories of thoughtfulness and preparation from the families interviewed for the study, few of the participants managed to create long-term savings because of unpredictable life events like collapses in wages, hospitalizations, or unexpected childcare costs. If instability has become the new norm, a second effect of the winner-take-all economy on workers' lives is the absence of economic mobility, the chance to get ahead. My parents and their parents before them felt, like most Americans, a confidence that their kids would be better off than they were. Incomes rose in the United States in every decade leading up to the Great Depression, and then again in the decades that followed. Jobs were changing with every decade, but pay was consistently rising. Across the board today, it has become less likely that people born into poor middle-class households will move up the economic ladder. In the America of the 1950s, a child had a 9 out of 10 chance of making more money than their parents. But today, it's only 50%. Today, a child born into poverty in France has a better chance of entering the highest social classes than one born in the United States. The majority of middle-class Americans today are stuck where they are, or they're falling. If you're in the middle, you're stuck in the middle, which means there's less space for others to move into the middle, says Elizabeth Jacobs, the Senior Director for Policy and Academic Programs at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth. As jobs have become increasingly unreliable, they don't offer the same chance to move up and out that they once did. We shouldn't let nostalgia for the good old days of economic mobility allow us to forget that it was largely one class of Americans, white men, who were able to take advantage of available economic opportunities. Policymakers across the country and in Washington consistently made decisions that made it easier for whites to get ahead and harder for minorities, particularly African Americans. Few African Americans were able to take advantage of early social assistance programs like the Homestead Act, which gave each settler 160 acres in exchange for a commitment to work the land. African Americans were denied access to many of the land-grant colleges that provided free education to farmers who wanted it. Most Southern universities refused to admit African Americans until the late 1960s. Later, in the middle of the 20th century, the GI Bill provided service members returning home after the Second World War with low-interest loans and low-cost mortgages, but only to those who are white. Banks for most of American history refused to lend to African Americans, even well after the passage of the Civil Rights Act. Similarly, elected officials made it difficult for women to purchase and own property for much of American history. Women lacked access to many professional schools, like law schools and medical schools, and the financially rewarding careers that result. Even today, men are paid consistently more in jobs than women who do the exact same work, and we have no national paid leave policies to help new parents, particularly mothers, balance work and children. We don't need to go back in time and make America great again by recreating a world that provided economic mobility to a select group. We need to build a new economic order that empowers all Americans to get ahead. A third and final effect of the new economy on working people is an exorbitant and growing cost of living. The NPR show Marketplace, in collaboration with Frontline and PBS NewsHour, crunched the data on the cost of everything from fast food to healthcare and movie tickets to gas between 1995 and 2015. Their finding was conclusive. Middle-class life has become 30% more expensive in the past 20 years. In that same time, Americans haven't received a raise. The rise in expense of three essentials, housing, healthcare, and education, accounts for the bulk of the cost explosion. Even after adjusting for inflation, college tuition fees are 2.5 times what they were 20 years ago, while the cost of childcare and medical care are double what they were in 1997. Housing, food, and energy costs are similarly 50% more expensive than they were then. The only things that have gotten much cheaper are television sets, toys, and software. The production of things like healthcare, education, and housing has not gotten meaningfully more efficient through automation or globalization because they all rely on cognitive human labor, which is harder to automate or ship overseas than manufacturing processes. You might be able to buy a less expensive television made in a Chinese factory, but you can't save money by sending your kids to a preschool in Beijing. Unfortunately, these trends show no signs of slowing down. As state and federal governments tighten their belts, tuition and medical expenses are trending upward. While artificial intelligence will likely bring down the cost of some goods, costs will likely continue to rise in the industries that most rely on human expertise, like education and healthcare. Business journalist Jordan Weissman points out that prices are rising on the very things that are essential for climbing out of poverty. A college education has become a necessary passport to financial stability. It's hard to hold a job if you're chronically ill. Working full-time is difficult if you can't pay somebody to watch your child. A high cost of living is not just a problem for the poor. The cost squeeze affects most of the middle class as well. The poor struggle to pay heating bills and make rent. While the middle class may not be going to bed hungry, the rising costs of housing, healthcare, and education mean many of them live on the financial brink. We rely on the monthly job report with fresh unemployment numbers to gauge how well the economy is doing for working people. But it says nothing about these hidden problems that many employed people still have. In a world in which a job meant stability and opportunity, it made sense to look at the number of jobs as a barometer of how well people were faring in the economy. Lots of people today have a job, but do not have any semblance of financial security in their lives. There's a reason we have a reactionary president who leverages populist rhetoric at a time of record low unemployment. We have the power to fix these problems by creating an income floor to support and stabilize the lives of poor and working class Americans. A guaranteed income for working people. Here's what I propose we do. Government should provide a guaranteed income of $500 a month to every adult who lives in a household making less than $50,000 per year and who is working in some way. This would add up to $6,000 a year for a single person or $12,000 a year for a married couple. A family of four making $38,000 a year would see their annual income rise to $50,000, a huge boost to their bottom line. A single worker at Walmart who works 25 hours a week for 10 bucks an hour would see her income increase from $13,000 to $19,000. The guaranteed income would create a floor below which people could not fall, a reliable foundation for people to build on. It wouldn't be enough money on its own for anyone to live on. It would supplement income from other sources like formal labor, a job in the gig economy, informal work, or other government benefits. Everyone who contributes to their community would earn the income, even if they're not making money in the formal economy. That would include mothers and fathers of young kids, adults caring for aging parents, and college students. A fruit picker or Lyft driver would have a monthly cash stipend they could plan on, even if it were a bad season or fewer people needed rides one particular month. A student would have a foundation to be able to pursue her studies full-time. And a mother with young kids would have extra cash to help with the cost of diapers and clothes. A guaranteed income would stabilize erratic financial lives and give people extra cash to invest in themselves and their families. A guaranteed income of this size would lift 20 million people out of poverty overnight and provide financial stability to many in the middle class. It would give people the chance to invest in themselves to start a small business or to move to a new city for a new job. It would help people keep up with the rising cost of living. They could spend the money on whatever was most important to them, housing, healthcare, education, childcare, or something else. But perhaps most importantly, the guaranteed income would embrace the dignity and freedom of people to chase their own dreams with no restrictions. Anyone who made more than $50,000 would not get the money because they would have enough income to make ends meet. This amount would be adjusted by the cost of living in each state. In California, it'd be a bit higher, and in Alabama, it'd be a bit lower. But no one in the middle class would pay for it either. A tax on the incomes of the richest Americans, those who make more than $250,000 a year, would underwrite the program in its entirety. A guaranteed income of this size would provide 60 million adults with monthly checks at a new annual cost of $290 billion, about half of what we spend each year on defense. It's important to be clear about the scale of this program. It would be big and expensive. It would be the fourth largest social benefit in government, just behind Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. This level of spending is ambitious, but it's feasible if we have the political will to do it. We could begin more modestly and scale the program up over time, just as we've done with other programs like Social Security. When President Franklin Roosevelt signed the first Social Security bill, it barely covered half of the working population, but it grew over decades to cover virtually every American. We could start the guaranteed income at $150 per month, taking the cost down dramatically to less than $50 billion, and then increase it gradually over time. Over the long term, the income should rise to the level of $500, but we shouldn't be afraid to start more modestly to get there. Given the glacial pace of change in Washington, we can also begin organizing in states to create smaller, state-based income floors. To be clear, I'm not proposing a universal basic income. Proponents of that idea favor giving every American, regardless of their wealth or whether they work, $1,000 a month with no strings attached at a cost of several trillion dollars. A guaranteed income for working people, by contrast, would go to a more narrow set of recipients, specifically working people in need, and it would cost much less. The idea of a guaranteed income that encourages work isn't a fringe idea. Nearly a dozen Nobel Prize-winning economists believe that it's a smart way to grow the economy and reduce inequality. Many of them do not make their case from a moral perspective, but from a practical one. The pie is growing bigger. There's no guarantee that everyone will benefit if we leave the market alone, explains Nobel laureate Sir Christopher Pissarides, a professor at the London School of Economics, whose words echo comments of other Nobel Prize winners. A universal minimum income is one of those ways, in fact, it is one I am very much in favor of, as long as we know how to apply it without taking away incentive to work at the lower end of the market. A guaranteed income designed in this particular way, $500 a month to working people making under 50 grand, would be the most powerful tool we have to combat income inequality in our country. And it would encourage work by making it pay. Worthwhile work. My father worked as a traveling salesman at Snyder Paper Corporation for 39 years. On his last day on the job before he retired, his colleagues rented the ballroom at the Holiday Inn in our hometown of Hickory for a farewell lunch. I was in eighth grade at the time, and I got to take the day off from school, a nearly unprecedented event in our family, to join the celebration. My dad was visibly anxious as we walked into the hotel. He carried a leather-bound notebook in which he'd written his speech, and he kept passing it from one hand to the other while compulsively clearing his throat. His nerves were contagious. I felt butterflies in my own stomach as we passed a banner emblazoned with his name in big letters, congratulating him on his long run. Pacing back and forth between our small dining room and kitchen, he had rehearsed his speech for days, speaking with a formal, foreign-seeming diction, with little trace of his usual southern lilt. This was one of the most important moments of his life, and he wanted to get it right. That was 20 years ago, and I can't remember a thing he said when he finally stood at the podium. I do, however, remember his fellow salesmen, the managers in suits and ties, and the warehouse workers encircling him afterward, smiling broadly and laughing as they shook his hand and hugged him. He was the center of attention, and his community had come out to support him. For 1 hour of one afternoon, at the very end of his career, he got to be small-town royalty. My father had always been a charmer. At work, he was everyone's confidant, their trusted advisor, informal therapist, and professional ally. He was the first to know when a secretary was pregnant, if a boss was cheating on his wife, or if a customer had lost a loved one. He didn't collect his intel from gossip, but from quiet confidences shared in office hallways. People knew they could trust him. My dad's customers, the people who bought the industrial paper he was selling, were some of his closest friends. He took care of them by listening to their stories, celebrating their successes, and comforting them in the worst of times. They took care of him in return. When he was 50, an inner ear condition caused him to become completely deaf in one ear. Before his eardrum was removed, he would suffer debilitating attacks of dizziness, nausea, and vertigo that came on without warning. On multiple occasions, his customers literally caught him as he fell and watched over him until he recovered or my mother arrived to take him home. The professional community my dad built might have been stronger than most, but the relationships we cultivate in our workplaces are often sources of deep fulfillment. The Harvard political scientist Robert Putnam, who chronicled the erosion of civic and political engagement over the second half of the 20th century in his book, Bowling Alone, believes that the one source of enduring community in many Americans' lives is around the water cooler, at work. Professionals and blue-collar workers alike are putting in long hours together, eating lunch and dinner together, traveling together, arriving early, and staying late, he writes. People are divorcing more often, marrying later, if at all, and living alone in unprecedented numbers. Work is where the heart is, then, for so many solitary souls. Every second Wednesday, my father's sales route required him to spend a night away so he could visit his customers in small, sleepy towns in the Western Carolinas with names like Shelby, Cherryville, and Gaffney. On summer Wednesdays, my mom and I, both out of school and with time to spare, would pile into his blue Oldsmobile and join him. Those nights away from home were a welcome break for me, an excuse to do something out of the ordinary. I had to sit in the stifling heat of the car while my dad made his sales calls. But then I got to play in the pool at the Fairfield Inn in the evening and get snacks and sodas from the vending machine. Paradise for an 8-year-old. On one trip, it was too hot to wait in the car, so I accompanied my father into a small industrial building somewhere in rural South Carolina. The room smelled of ink and musk, and fans circulated the dusty, stale air. I had a Game Boy in hand, but I was really listening to my dad's conversation with the customer, who was in his 50s and balding. He spoke with an unusually thick accent, making it difficult for me to understand everything he said. My dad and he exchanged seemingly endless, lighthearted banter. Then, at the end of their conversation, they got serious while they pored over a white binder with my dad's company logo on top. A moment later, we ducked outside, and I remember feeling a cool breeze on my face. My happy anticipation of the AC of the car, now in sight, paled in comparison to how elated my father was. He swung my hand in his, laughing, as we walked back to the car. He had made a big sale, and his joy was infectious. I have no doubt that some of his happiness that day came from the financial reward it would bring him, but even then, I knew that it wasn't just about the money. I could feel that my father had achieved something unexpected, something he felt he deserved, and he was relishing the sense of accomplishment. Still today, he can talk enthusiastically about the weights of industrial paper sizes, the kinds of paper that work on certain printers, and the variety of colors to choose from. He enjoyed the challenge of his work at least as much as the relationships he was able to build along the way. While not every day was fantastic, and there were many setbacks and tense evenings at home. My father wanted to work. The same goes for my mother, who loved her job teaching. She retired a few years earlier than most people do, just shy of her 60th birthday. In her final years at the small high school where she taught math, she had grown increasingly beleaguered with the non-teaching duties the school required of her. School administrators expected her to be hall monitor, bus line supervisor, and occasional public safety officer in her own classroom, as well as a talented instructor of algebra, geometry, and pre-calculus. But she loved what she did, because she knew that every now and then, she shaped the trajectory of one of her students' lives. Some became teachers themselves, still others, engineers or architects. Even after retiring, she volunteered to tutor students who were struggling. Once when I was 9 or 10, a 20-something woman awkwardly approached our table at a fish camp, shorthand for a cheap southern seafood restaurant, where the featured items on the menu are popcorn shrimp, fried flounder, and coleslaw. "Mrs. Hughes," she said as she sidled up next to us, "I just wanted to let you know how much of a difference you made in my life. I never got a chance to tell you that, and I am just so grateful." My mom tilted her head to the side and gave a warm, toothy smile, nodding in appreciation and thanks. They chatted briefly, and a moment after the woman left, my mom turned back to my father and me and said sheepishly, "I have never seen that woman before in my life." She wasn't forgetful or insincere. It was just that she had taught thousands and thousands of students over the years. Even she couldn't keep track of the impact she had. Most people in America, at least in this regard, are a lot like my parents. I've talked with historians, economists, scholars, cashiers, and gig economy workers about how technology is changing work and what people believe is core to who Americans are. There's one thing that both elite and ordinary people on the left and the right tend to agree on. People are better off when they work. They, of course, need to work to be able to afford the basics of a roof over their heads, food on the table, an education for their kids, and to see a doctor when they're sick. But people also want to work because it gives their lives meaning, community, and purpose. Every person deserves to feel a sense of reward from their work, just as much as they deserve a sense of financial security in their lives. Normally, those who advocate for a guaranteed income don't talk a lot about work. If they do, many tend to see a guaranteed income as a way to prepare for a world without work, or at least a time when there will be a lot less of it. But I believe work is essential to who we are and who we want to be. Work that is rewarding and meaningful, including traditionally unpaid work, like caregiving and getting an education, makes us happier, healthier, and more fulfilled. We know this intuitively, but psychological studies also show that people who work are happier, are healthier, and even live longer. By contrast, people who lack paid employment for long periods of time have a much higher rate of falling into depression, exhibiting symptoms like irritability, difficulty concentrating and making decisions, and insomnia. The unemployed also report higher rates of feeling like they are a disappointment to their families or to themselves. Having a new job can reverse those feelings over time, but it takes longer to recover from depression than it does to fall into it. The pain that comes from joblessness can be deep, enduring, and stubbornly persistent. The stress and depression that accompany unemployment can have a very real and concrete impact on our bodies and even cause us to die earlier. Ann Case and Angus Deaton's recent shocking studies have drawn attention to the rising death rates among white Americans without high school degrees, some of the people who have been the most affected by changes in the labor market. Case and Deaton's work connects these deaths of despair, as they call them, to the cumulative disadvantages that follow from low employment. Higher rates of substance abuse and suicide are at fault for many of the negative health effects and early deaths that are correlated with unemployment. Unemployed people are more prone to alcohol and drug abuse, and the kind of psychological struggles that lead people to early death by suicide. Someone who is unemployed is more than twice as likely to use illegal drugs than someone who's employed full-time. The correlation between unemployment rates and opioid abuse in particular is staggering. For every 1% increase in the unemployment rate in a given county, the opioid death rate rises by nearly 4%, and emergency room visits rise by 7%. While it's true that work seems to keep us healthier, sometimes we can take our obsession with work too far. Political leaders glorify the dignity of work and claim work of any sort is better than no work at all. Donald Trump and Joe Biden compete to see who can speak more for Scranton values, grounding their arguments in the idea that even demeaning jobs are better than no jobs. Civil rights activists have historically voiced similar ideas. Martin Luther King Jr., in his speeches about labor, celebrated the dignity of work. "If a man is called to be a street sweeper," he said in 1967, "he should sweep streets even as a Michelangelo painted, or Beethoven composed music, or Shakespeare wrote poetry. He should sweep streets so well that all the hosts of heaven and earth will pause to say, 'Here lived a great street sweeper who did his job well.' No work is insignificant. All labor that uplifts humanity has dignity and importance and should be undertaken with painstaking excellence. Even the smallest contributions to society are worthwhile, but it's also true that we should want more meaningful work that can't just be done by a machine. The problem with the glorification of the dignity of work is that it flattens the idea of work itself and makes no distinction between purposeful work, busy work, and work to destructive ends. Some work is meaningful and rewarding, and other work, sheer drudgery. Some work is directed toward destructive ends. Drug dealers and insider traders have strong work ethics, too. When we imbue the dignity of work with a kind of religious meaning, it obscures the fact that the kind of work we want more of is the kind that is purpose-driven and fulfilling, positive, substantive work that earns esteem. Unfortunately, a lot of work in America today is draining and tedious. Retail and service sector jobs, the fastest growing category of jobs in America, can involve standing over a fast food cash register or deep fryer for hours on end. Backbreaking construction jobs require workers to toil outdoors in all seasons, including in the depths of winter. Home and office cleaning jobs are some of the least rewarding and most physically punishing jobs out there, not to mention the lots of coal miners or slaughterhouse workers. While even bad jobs provide a sense of purpose to some, many are stuck in them because they're the only options they have to pay the bills. The dignity of work phrase is often co-opted and used as a cynical tool, especially by people on the political right, to force people out of social welfare programs. Francis Fox Piven and Bruce Cloward documented in their landmark history, Regulating the Poor, the myriad ways that government has used arbitrary rules to inspect people's homes, to ban them from having color televisions, or to force women to answer extremely personal questions. An early version of welfare, called Aid for Families with Dependent Children, or AFDC, may have seemed generous in spirit, but was invasive in practice. AFDC mothers, for example, are often forced to answer questions about their sexual behavior, like, when did you last menstruate? Open their closets to inspection, like, whose pants are those? And permit their children to be interrogated, like, do any men visit your mother? Piven and Cloward wrote. Unannounced raids, usually after midnight and without benefit of warrant, in which a recipient's home is searched for signs of quote-unquote immoral activities, have also been part of life on AFDC. Work requirements follow in a long tradition of similar kinds of regulations organized to regulate the lives of the poor rather than actually encouraging any kind of meaningful, rewarding work. This continues today. For example, Arkansas's governor, Asa Hutchinson, has aggressively implemented work requirements across every major social safety net program in his state in order to reduce the number of people who qualify. He has kicked tens of thousands of people off of food stamps by proclaiming that if you can't find a job that employs you for 20 hours a week in Arkansas, you no longer qualify for any kind of nutritional assistance. Even in a period of low unemployment, there are still tens of thousands of Arkansans who find themselves temporarily jobless in any given month, often through no fault of their own. Several states are looking to follow suit, and Republicans are considering implementing a similar kind of requirement nationally. As if that's not enough, Hutchinson has requested a waiver from the federal government to implement the same policy for the 240,000 residents of his state who are too poor to afford health care and rely on Medicaid when they have emergencies. In the periods of life when they don't have a job, they will have no access to affordable health insurance. In Arkansas, work requirements is code for a strategy to make the lives of poor people more difficult. Enforcement of these work requirements plays into dangerous racial stereotypes about who is benefiting from government assistance. The infamous welfare queens, invoked by Ronald Reagan, are a mythological figure in American consciousness with deep roots in racist stereotypes. The dignity of work is often used to invoke imagery of white men on assembly lines, demonstrating determination and resilience to provide for their families, in implied contrast to images of black women who passively rely on government handouts. Nothing could be further from the truth. In fact, labor force participation rates are higher for single black mothers, 76%, than for white men at 72%. And that doesn't even take into account any non-traditional work, like caregiving, that many women do. The malicious ways work requirements have been used in the past make me suspicious of some calls on the left for a federal job guarantee in lieu of a guaranteed income. Its basic premise is that the tens of millions of people who aren't participating in the formal workforce can only be guaranteed economic security if they sign up for newly created, but still undefined, government jobs. One of the most concrete plans put forward by journalist Jeff Spross imagines that municipal government employees will hunt out local infrastructure projects and ask churches and civic organizations to submit ideas for new jobs. People seeking jobs would come to these local offices, which would draw on the federal databases to link the potential workers up with the most appropriate projects, he writes. Crucially, workers would be matched with nearby jobs according to skills they already have. The cost would be significantly higher than a guaranteed income, up to $775 billion a year for 14 million new government employees. There's little evidence that such a job guarantee program would work. A 2015 study by prominent economists ranked the effectiveness of 200 examples of labor market interventions. They found that subsidized public sector employment programs consistently came in last, sometimes even having negative impacts. The arguments for a federal job guarantee require faith in government's ability to connect people to jobs they want and need. The idea of relying on a DMV-like federal jobs database to help local nonprofits and churches match 14 million people up with new jobs seems far-fetched at best. Government can and already does provide good public service jobs to lots of people. Nearly 15% of the American workforce is already employed by federal, state, or local government. But relying on a job guarantee to provide broad economic stability is a step too far. It falls squarely in the tradition of government telling poor and middle-class people what to do with their lives dictating what counts as a real job and what doesn't. What we need instead is a social policy that provides people with opportunities to find the kinds of fulfilling work they want and deserve. The best way to guarantee that is to empower people with cash to secure extra training, pay for childcare, or move to a place with more opportunities. As we'll see later, evidence from existing American programs shows that a little bit of cash doesn't cause people to drop out of the workforce, but instead helps them find work. If people have financial stability from a guaranteed income, they can choose work that's fulfilling, purpose-driven, and a match for their skills. Today, a Walmart worker who suffers from harassment in the workplace or extreme scheduling demands receives no unemployment insurance if she quits. With a guaranteed income in the background, she wouldn't be able to drop out of the workforce altogether, but she would have a small cushion to help make ends meet for a few months while she looked for a new job. Because her tax return showed she worked last year, she'd receive the guaranteed income for the entirety of this year. That kind of security would also allow her to turn down a dead-end job, even if it paid a little more than one that might grow into something better in time. For some people, the most fulfilling and rewarding work may not be paid at all. This uncompensated work plays an important role in our society, and we should recognize it as the real work it is. In our modern technical language, people are said to be working only if they have formal paid employment from a legally recognized business entity. They receive W-4 or 1099 forms, their salaries are regulated by minimum wage laws, and their productivity is counted as a part of economic statistics, like GDP. But historically, these lines were not so brightly drawn. On the farm my grandfather grew up on, everyone was expected to pitch in to grow crops, keep house, and take care of one another. We wouldn't recognize much of this activity today as work, even though it clearly was. Our current definition of work is a relatively recent invention that emerged as people moved off family farms and into employment relationships that could be codified and made visible to the state. Work became narrowly defined and tended to line up with the activities of white men. But a parent who stays at home today, takes care of young children, cooks, cleans, and runs errands, is no less productive than a factory worker or an entrepreneur. An adult who takes care of an aging loved one, dressing, feeding, and bathing mom or dad, has full days of exhausting, socially valuable activity. Students who spend hours and hours a week sitting in classrooms, studying at night, writing papers, and preparing for tests are also working, just not for pay. As long as you're doing something for your community, we should recognize you as a worker. This would be a bigger and more modern definition of work than what we have used for the past few decades, and more in line with the long-term historical view of what work really is. 30 million Americans participate in this unrecognized workforce and are barred from many of the government benefits tied to work, causing many of them to live at or near the poverty line. According to the American Enterprise Institute, a conservative think tank, a quarter of the people who live in poverty do not work in paid jobs because childcare or elder care would cost more than they would earn. Another fifth of the unemployed people who are below the poverty line are in school. In other words, nearly half of the quote-unquote non-working poor are working to provide care for their families or to improve themselves through education. All of these examples, childcare, elder care, and higher education, are already visible on the tax returns that Americans file. We claim dependents and report the tuition that we pay. We do not need to create any new bureaucracy to verify the claims because they're audited by the Internal Revenue Service each year. A more expansive definition of work should also include community and religious service and artistic work, although these are harder to verify. Over the long term, we should determine how to verify if people are involved in any of these activities in order to include them in this broader definition of work. But we can start today by including caregiving and education in how we shape our social policy. That way, we can begin to recognize the contributions that tens of millions of people in alternative work arrangements are making for their families and communities. Perhaps counterintuitively, many of these jobs are the jobs of the future. Caregiving in particular is an area of massive job growth. Our country's fastest growing demographic is people over age 85. And by 2050, the total number of elderly in need of personal care will number 27 million, more than double the number today. Many people are naturally distrustful of the institutions that house the elderly, seemingly for good reason. The majority of people who end up in nursing homes die within 2 years, even though nearly half of Medicaid's entire budget funds the exorbitant fees they require. Many Americans would prefer to take care of their aging loved ones at home, and it seems that it might help them live longer and lower the costs of care. But the people who take on care and housing responsibilities directly pay a steep personal cost. 70% of caregivers report making changes such as cutting back on their working hours, changing jobs, stopping work entirely, taking a leave of absence, or other such changes as a result of their caregiving role, scholar and organizer Ai-Jen Poo notes in her book, The Age of Dignity. The amount of income caregivers forfeit is staggering. More than $300,000 per person over the course of a lifetime, according to the AARP. Often they do this work without support for or even acknowledgement of the extra work, which diminishes their ability to be present and productive in other arenas of life. Our aging parents and grandparents will increasingly need caregiving at home, but our current policies do not recognize this as work. Nor do they recognize the work of the tens of millions of parents of children under the age of 5 who demand constant attention from a parent or other relative. Mothers in particular spend enormous amounts of time feeding, washing, cleaning, and cooking, but have never had their work recognized for what it is. A small group of economists has strived over decades to precisely quantify the value of work that goes uncounted in domestic activities like childcare and elder care, food preparation, cleaning, and home maintenance. By using the American Time Use Survey, a widely trusted method for quantifying the amount of time Americans spend on different activities, they estimate that America's GDP would be a full 26% higher if we counted domestic labor as work. That means that over $4 trillion of economic activity is going unrecognized because of our outdated definitions of who is working, not to mention the fact that these workers don't get paid. Historically, the people who do this unrecognized work are disproportionately women and people of color, groups that the law has consistently neglected. Even these numbers do not recognize the work of the millions of students enrolled in American universities. Students aren't paid for their time because the effort they invest today will pay off in future years. But every student deserves to have basic financial stability to enable them to focus on their studies and help supplement the cost of food or childcare. Wealthy students have the advantage of a kind of guaranteed income from parents who want to do everything possible to keep them focused on their studies. Poor and middle-class students deserve the same. In an ideal world, every person should have the chance to do work they love. The satisfaction my parents got from their jobs showed me at a young age what's possible when you love your work. The opportunity to advocate for a guaranteed income in my day-to-day work is one of the most fulfilling parts of my life. A few hundred extra dollars a month isn't going to mean everyone gets to have the job they want overnight. But it is the kind of boost that a person can use to invest in vocational school or to move closer to a job they think fits their skills best. It can be a universal strike fund, which enables someone to quit a job with an abusive manager. It can allow a person to reduce their hours, to make more time at home, to take care of a young child or aging parent. It can be the seed money to start a small business around the corner or on Etsy. A guaranteed income would give millions more people a little more of a chance to choose the work that is right for them. A small number of people who are unable to work, particularly the infirm, disabled, or geographically isolated, may be left behind